Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute. As we prepare for Season 3 of The Trust Makers, we wanted to share some of our favorite moments from Season 2. Take a listen to this collection of interviews with leaders from across industries and institutions to learn how they repaired, built, and maintained trust in their organizations. We'll kick off our first episode from Season 2. Kofi Amugodfrey, Chief Marketing Officer at DoorDash, interviewed by Smith Aretti, live at Advertising Week in New York from October 2022.
You're quite interesting, Kofi, in many ways, getting to know you. But, you know, we're living in really complex times, right? Be it the pandemic, the social justice movement that we've all witnessed. And your philosophy in marketing has really been, you know, to lean in. When a lot of people feel comfortable leaning out, right? So talk a little bit about your philosophy and DoorDash's philosophy and the structure that you've put in place to really address social issues.
Yeah, I mean, our view is that when it comes to social issues, you kind of don't have a choice. So I don't think we even see it as a choice to lean in or not, because I think for a long time it was actually okay to like sit on the sidelines of a lot of these issues. But now it's kind of damned if you do and damned if you don't. Right? So if you don't speak out, you're going to get called out for not speaking out. And if you do speak out and you don't have the receipts to back it up, you're going to get called out for not having the receipts. So I think our approach has been like, we don't believe you can be sort of agnostic of these issues. Like, they're real, they're in the world, they affect our audiences, they affect our employees. So you have to engage. But then you need a framework to engage, because it's really easy to get dragged into every issue. It's very distracting for organizations, very distracting for people. And also, you find many organizations taking a position on things that they're not actually doing. So we wanted to create a framework that would actually hold us accountable. So our thing was, like, what is DoorDash fundamentally about? We're about empowering local economies. And when we think about that, the way to do that is you actually have to empower everyone in the economy. You have to empower Dashers who are looking to earn. You have to empower businesses to grow. You have to empower customers who need stuff brought to them. And so we have this notion that the through line for how we think about this framework is about equality of opportunity. Like, DoorDash is fundamentally about like helping the local business compete in a world that's gone online. So how do we take that core concept and bring it to social issues?
Manu Mial, CEO of Bridge USA, interviewed by Amanda Edelman in December 2022.
I absolutely love this. So basically, you're creating sort of groups of people and sort of safe spaces for people to really get into it and really talk about things and issues that are taboo, that are uncomfortable. Can you give maybe a couple of examples of sessions that you've created or facilitated that have gone really well, or maybe some that have gone less well, and just things that you've learned from it?
So there's one thing I'm going to push back on just a little bit, which is the word safe spaces. You know, for us, because that phrase has become so politicized, like almost everything has, whether it's free speech or safe spaces or change or progress. The first thing we do is we just don't use those words. And part of the reason is I mean, the work that you all have done through Edelman, the trust barometer that you all have released that shows how mistrusting people are, especially at this moment, I think people are looking for reasons to say no. And our job is to be as open as possible to get the maximum amount of people into the room. So that's the first thing I would say. In terms of discussions and dialogues, let me just get really tactical for a second. So Bridge USA currently has 50 college chapters, 20 high school chapters. The goal of a college chapter or high school chapter is creating a space within campus. We call them civic spaces. Basically, just like in cities, how we have green spaces, this is an environment for you to be able to constructively engage and talk about issues that are very difficult, or talk about issues like whether or not a hot dog is a sandwich. You know, we don't need to build trust over the most divisive issues. We can build trust on a lot of different things. The most important thing that our students are doing is they're helping people see the possibility of conversation with people that are different than ourselves. Because I think we live in this moment right now where a dialogue with someone that's different than you just sounds like a life-sucking experience. Like no one is like getting out of bed being like, I want to have an ideological brawl today, right? And so when the biggest criticism we often face is like, do people actually change their minds? And I think that's the wrong question. I think the most important thing is that we've, again, forgotten the ability to communicate, which is so important to us as people.
My conversation with Tim Davey, Director General of the BBC, live from Davos at the 2023 World Economic Forum from January 2023.
I saw some really interesting research that the majority of 16 to 34-year-olds don't believe anyone can be impartial. They just don't, they believe everyone is kind of spinning. So we're now having to be much more overt and say, look, our objective is really to get to the facts. And let me explain a process. It's not just me doing my best intent. We have strong editorial guidelines. This is our verification systems. This isn't an accident that we are delivering fact-based journalism. Yeah. It's a process.
And I think this is very much about being transparent about your own editorial guidelines and making sure that people are aware of your guidelines.
Well, our latest trail that basically is talking about BBC News and what it does actually flips up the editorial guidelines and said, here they are, have a look at them. This is what we do. In Ukraine, we need to witness something, but then we need to verify it. I think this has broader implications in the media. For your listening in any business, and I think this can be uncomfortable territory for businesses that present a front over many decades. I think you have to think, okay, what would happen if we were radically transparent? If people could unpick our processes, they could visit our factory. My factory is the editorial floor, yeah? Or the program makers in natural history. I'll give you an example. We now, when we make a natural history program featuring, say, a lion, a pride of lions, or in the Antarctic, there was a kind of debate about how those shots were made. Did they do some in the zoo? And so the natural history programming went through a bit of a seminal moment a few years ago. And what it said, no, we're going to show exactly what happened. So now you get a 50-minute program, if it's an hour, you get 10 minutes on the making of. It's one of the most popular sections of our programming. And it literally just shows you how the program was made. If we needed to do something in more kind of manufactured conditions, which you don't often, but you may say, look, this plant, we showed it, we grew it in here. We show the whole process all the way through. Very popular, and trust is built.
That sounds like a great way to fight misinformation.
Sally Sussman, Chief Corporate Affairs Officer at Pfizer, interviewed by Kirsty Graham from March 2023.
I was thinking about what has happened to the communications of science as well. Part of a discussion in Davos where a participant said, you know, what has happened is that we have to be able to connect science in a way that's much more personal, that is much more emotional. If you think about that, we had a pandemic and also an infodemic. We're living in really polarized times. You know, you make a lot of really great examples in the book about how you change the approach of comms in the pandemic and given what Pfizer was going through. Can you say a little bit about how you did make those connections more immediate and more emotional to people as you explained the science?
So science, which used to be sort of a remote, esoteric discussion during the pandemic, became everybody's dinner conversation. Did you test today? Is so-and-so positive? What do you think about wearing a mask? And I think that's a change that is actually for the good. It had a lot of positive outcomes. For example, we were able to field our clinical trial for our COVID vaccines so quickly because everybody was engaged in it. It wasn't, you know, like a rare disease that affects only a few people. So the fact that there was democracy to the pandemic in that it didn't know boundaries, it didn't know class differentiation, it didn't know gender. It was just this virus impacting everyone, meant that people, families, children, grandma, grandpa were all talking about science. And I'm very proud of the Science Will Win campaign that we did. It wasn't Pfizer Will Win, it was Science Will Win, because science was the hero of the pandemic. And I think that brought a humanizing relevancy to science that hadn't maybe existed before.
C.D. Glynn, president of the PepsiCo Foundation and global head of philanthropy at PepsiCo, interviewed by Alex Heath, live from South by Southwest, March 2023.
We just released our Edelman Trust Barometer, our 2023 Trust Barometer, and we found that economic optimism in 24 of the 28 countries that we surveyed are at all-time lows. So that means that the majority of people globally do not see in the next 5 years that they and their families will be better off. So how are you thinking about economic opportunity? How are you working on economic opportunity now, especially in this moment when people are already facing hardships? They're worrying about an economic recession or an impending recession, and they are pessimistic.
That reality is not only, you know, coming through from the Edelman Trust Barometer. We hear it within the walls of our business, because as society goes, so does PepsiCo as a company, but so do our employees. And so we really have a strong commitment to not only hear from the communities, but to be a positive force in those communities. And so in 2020, during not only the pandemic, the health pandemic, there was also the racial reckoning that transpired. And so the company sort of said, what do we do in the communities where we live and work? And so our CEO, so CEO down, top-down driven, but bottom-up owned, sort of said we need to have this racial equality journey, and made a commitment of over $500 million to communities that really had an outsized disparate level of suffering, if you will, during the pandemic. And that, again, as you said, it's the hangover. Yeah. You know, it's not hangover one, hangover two, hangover three. This might be hangover five or six or whatever, you know, version it is. I mean, there's the reality of the pandemic hangover that we needed to address. And so the company, in all of its largesse, said we need to really focus in on communities. And so one thing that we've been really clear on is that we need to be really a key contributor to positivity in the communities, and to be a real contributor to really bringing about change. And so we have a number of programs that are designed to really create more equity, to really create a catalytic effect in terms of positivity, and to really change people's lives and livelihoods directly. And so through programs such as a community college program that we have for Black and Hispanic students, through a program of Black and Hispanic business accelerator, a restaurant accelerator, food service businesses, restaurants that we're supporting in communities all over the U.S., and through a Black nonprofit leaders program. These are programs that are directly impacting the community, but they're providing funds, they're providing mentorship, they're providing management, they're providing connections, all the things that are needed, not only to help people today. So the financial support is great, but they need the business acumen to survive, adapt to the new normal, and then to thrive. And so we're showing up with, from the business side, you know, saying that PepsiCo is here and we're going to continue buying and sourcing and making great products with the communities. But we're also showing up from the philanthropic side to say we're here. We have grant capital that's going to help, hopefully, you know, provide grant capital to create a change in your communities that is going to be long lasting. So we're going to, you know, step in and be a catalyst for you to really move on beyond us. And so that's where the foundation is really, really a part of providing the needed resources. But we also know that there's long-term issues and then there's short-term issues. So Maybe that grant capital and that business funding is there, but we also have programs where, you know, people need to literally get through today. And so using our capabilities of the company to provide access to nutritious foods. So you talked about the realities of inflation and the recession, but one thing that we saw happen during COVID is that school closures. So we don't think about school. We think about schools as educational institutions, but schools are also a place where some children they're getting a meal. They're getting breakfast, they're getting lunch, and maybe, you know, depending on the schools, there may be something after school. We don't know if they're getting dinner or not. There's hidden hunger all over the U.S. You know, more than 25 million kids, 1 in 8 children in the U.S. being food insecure, 1 in 5 Black and brown kids in the U.S. food insecure. And so through our program, one program in the U.S. called Food for Good, we're able to source, using our capabilities at PepsiCo, source nutritious foods, pack it, and deliver it to schools in times when the government or the school district isn't providing. So school providing breakfast, but maybe not lunch. School's providing breakfast and lunch, but no after school. and during the summers, summer program. So we're looking at, again, I remember I said philanthropic capital can be de-risking capital coming in where places where government or the private sector doesn't come in. We're looking at that as provide access. So this is, you know, daily feeding of children in schools or in educational institutions where we're giving them access to food. So we can have the immediate impact, but we also have the long-term impact. But no matter what, we're really cognizant that times are tough. And in tough times, you know, we think we have a great, it's an opportunity for us to do more, but we also have a responsibility to do more than just create great products. We're using our size, our scale, and our commitment to communities to do more good for more people.
Ben Bright, Global Director of Trust Communications at Airbnb, interviewed by Jackie Cooper, April 2023.
We're known for our trust barometer. This year, business came out as the only institution among business, government, media, and NGOs that is seen as both competent and ethical. A 19-point jump in ethics since 2020, which is quite extraordinary. Do you feel that your consumers are asking this of you in terms of, you know, having this emphasis? And what have you done recently beyond the things that you've touched on to be ethical? Is this sort of ethical thought something that drives some of these decisions? And how do you communicate that with all of the consumers that you have globally?
Over in Ukraine, we started to see a really fascinating trend. As you know, I mentioned earlier ID verification, that we have these systems to verify you are a real person, you are who you say you are. And random community members started taking note of that and thinking, here's an interesting way to lend direct support to real people in Ukraine.
So I'm going to interrupt you because one of those people was me.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Okay. And not only did I rent several properties in Ukraine, I got about 20 of my friends to do it.
My goodness.
And one of those families has become a very close family to me, and they emigrated to Canada.
Oh, that's incredible.
And the money that she got and her friends got from us renting went to the maternity hospital to get doctors some help where babies were dying.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's obviously not something we planned for. I think it was just a regular person, you know, could have been you, who just had this idea and tweeted about it. And it became this incredible grassroots movement as it started to spread. And it really took on a life of its own. And it led to millions of dollars being sent directly to, you know, just regular Airbnb hosts throughout the country. We ended up waiving all of our fees. That was the decision we made to help kind of facilitate that further. And look, this is not what the platform was developed for. It was developed to facilitate real world experiences, but this was just something that took on a life of its own. It takes pausing and reflecting. Again, do we want to just let this happen in the background, or do we want to help, you know, actually amplify it and facilitate it? And we chose the latter. And I'm glad we did. You know, I think we saw a lot of examples of lives being changed.
My conversation with Mark Henderson, Director of Corporate Affairs at Wellcome Trust, from April 2023.
One of the most striking findings from the health report is that since the last year, trust in friends and family on health issues has risen 11 points to 76%. Can you talk a little bit about the ramifications of that rise?
Well, you're right. It's astonishing. And especially when you see that in some segments of the analysis, the level of trust in friends and family is comparable to the level of trust in medical professionals. I mean, it is a really astonishing finding. I think that some of what may lie behind it is also there in your data, because one of the other findings I found really striking was the series of questions that asked people what would make them trust more and what would make them trust health information. And the overarching theme of that was that people will trust when they're treated as equals and when they're treated as partners in the management of their health and the influence of their health, rather than as sort of passive vessels for information and being told what to do, especially then when they're uncertain that what they're being told to do is actually in their best interests rather than in the best interest of somebody else. For me, this was so arresting and interesting when you'll find that 60% were saying, include me in the science so that I can be confident that the science is actually being developed with people like me. Show how it fits my life, 62%. Give me a voice, 67%. These are the ways that one builds trust. And overall, I'm sure that's what's happening with this friends and family thing, because friends and family listen, they discuss, they are generally people who show you unequivocal love and support. They're people who you know have your best interests at heart. And I think that makes them more trustworthy in a certain way. Medical professionals, others can reach that level of trust. And indeed, I think with the higher trust group in your study, very successful in achieving that. But I think it was so interesting seeing again that when you looked at that lower trust, what was going to build trust? Let me ask questions. There's so much emerging evidence, I think, not just in healthcare, that this is really the new secret source of influencing people, is to win their trust by building rapport and by making it clear that you're not judging them. I think that many people feel when they're being given health advice that they are being judged, and that makes them less likely to accept and trust the advice. When they're discussing their health with friends and family, they don't feel they're being judged.
Oscar Munoz, former chairman and CEO of United Airlines, interviewed by Richard Edelman, May 2023.
As a fresh new CEO, I knew I didn't have a plan, and I sought help, and I cold called the Chicago Edelman office and literally got an assistant. And I said, hi, I'm Oscar Munoz. I'm the new guy at United. I would like to talk to someone in charge. Richard and I did not know each other, but his team came through magically with many an idea. And one of them was an extension of the letter I had written to my own employees about how do we go out live and let the world know that there was a new direction ahead. But importantly, and as you say, Richard, it was bold because it wasn't a speech or it wasn't an op-ed. It was a full-page ad. It got a lot of attention. This guy will never do it. Yeah, we've heard this crap before. They're so far behind, it'll never work. And while it sounds good, they should be spending their money on something smarter and wiser. But, you know, to your team and your good credit, Richard, it was the right thing to do because it began to set a tone and a pace and a direction that was my own premise of proof, not promise. So while at this point it was promise, it set the company forward on, there was an objective for everyone to see.
So Oscar, one of the most profound discussions you and I had was quite early in your tenure as CEO, where you said, I have to set a new relationship with labor. I need them to trust management. I need them to believe that, in fact, they can make a better living, but the deal has to be that they're going to deliver outstanding service every day. And you can get a better customer mix and all these things if you can deliver on that promise. That was a pretty gutsy move because your predecessors, each one of them, had a very contentious relationship with labor and was trying to squeeze labor costs down. You had the opposite approach. How did you understand that, in fact, this relationship between management and labor was the foundation for improving your strategy?
When I took over as CEO at this my former company, CSX, my instinct, I think to my heritage and how I was raised was, you know, people aren't angry for just no reason. And yes, union people may be whatever people like to say about them, but I know them to be human because, you know, my dad was a union meat cutter. My uncle was the head of the IBEW union. So in my life, I had seen the other side and I knew my dad and I knew my uncle. They were normal humans trying to make a life for themselves. So that was kind of my impetus and desire to connect. The situation was hard. And so that was the instinct, Richard, is like, I need to go find out exactly what it is for them before I try to fix it. It's a concept that I've learned to dub the listen, learn from that listening, and only then can you lead. And that initiated a lot of conversations that I had with people all, you know, all around the system at the frontline level.
Katie Welch, Chief Marketing Officer at Rare Beauty, interviewed by Amanda Edelman, May 2023.
I've always paid attention to generations who are driving culture that happens to be Gen Z. So I think understanding them through that lens, I guess, and staying close to them as much as I can. And then in getting to know Selena, that is who she is. She lives her life by her values. She is this super authentic, real, disarmingly so kind. So it's sort of like, as you get to know her, and then when you build a brand, you want to do things through the lens of the founder and getting to know the founder and saying, okay, this is her voice. And that's who she is. So that's how the brand was built, through her.
I just want to continue on this theme of living your values, because it's so true. And for Gen Z, I'll just say two stats that we often highlight. One is that they're so aware of how you treat your employers and your community, and that actually really affects their purchase decisions. 8 in 10 say how you treat your employees is important when considering purchase decisions. 7 in 10 say how you treat your community around you is important on purchase decisions. And the second stat that I'll give is that they have this forensic ability to get to the truth. 70% of them will always fact check what you say and unfollow you on social platforms if they find out that what you say is untrue. So I think what you've done is just be so genius about understanding this generation, you know, how much they care about the brands they buy, taking care of the communities and employees around them, as well as aligning values and words. And I would just love to understand, you know, how you do that.
The whole company, we all just pay attention. We're all on TikTok. We're all on Instagram. We're all using, at least the marketing team is all using the same sort of social channels. So it's like this constant stream of insight. To your earlier question about sort of how did you know about Gen Z, when we were building this brand, I didn't know a lot of Gen Z. I don't have teenage kids. I do have a TikTok account. And I used that as an opportunity. I've built my own community, but then I've gotten to know people beyond those with I work. And I've sort of got to hear from them and learn and gleaned a lot from the questions that they ask me. And that, I think, helps inform a lot of my understanding, my personal understanding of the generation. Certainly doesn't have all the answers, but I also can ask them questions.
Grace Cao, Global Head of Advertising Business Marketing at Spotify, interviewed by Jackie Cooper from the 2023 Cannes Lion Festival in June 2023.
A major finding in that Edelman Trust Barometer report for the brand space this week is that the traditional purchase funnel, which most marketers understandably have based their work on for decades, has collapsed. That's quite a big sentence to say. What we see in the data that there is a sort of this ongoing relationship loop, we've called it this loop, that goes on between consumers and brands, because we find that our research shows that consumers want to engage with brands beyond that moment of purchase. And so how do you think brands should think about building a relationship? Because I think with Spotify, it's such a great example of having a relationship that kind of becomes part of your life and your go-to space. How do you, as a marketeer, help brands understand that relationship? And how can you have that relationship and interaction rather than just that funnel mentality?
Yeah. Jackie, now I'm going to quote you, because the Trust Report, this latest one, is excellent. And there's a quote in there that said, "The purchase is just the beginning." And I think that summed it up really well, in the sense that, one, I would say consumers now, when they purchase something, it isn't just a value exchange, right? It is an investment in your brand. And I think that's the way I would say that brands need to start thinking about that, is that every dollar a consumer spends, or every minute they spend with you, it's an investment in your brand. And so as a brand, how do you think about that and value every interaction as someone investing in you so much more than perhaps a purchase? And I think that's when we talk about the purchase funnel collapsing, I think that's an opportunity, right? Because if you think about every interaction being truly someone who wants to hear from you, wants to connect with you, what a great opportunity for a brand to think of new experiences each time they have that interaction.
Jada Doyen McKenna, CEO of Mercy Corps, interviewed by Alex Heath, September 2023.
I think people are naturally a bit distrustful of organizations that are seen as pass-throughs, right? So we're implementers of the work. And our industry is really reckoning with a history of white saviorism and colonialism that persists today and that perpetuates power imbalances that put communities in the back seats when it comes to resource allocation and decision making. And as people's trust in other institutions ebbs and flows, I think those factors become more important. At Mercy Corps, for sure, and across the sector, we are reckoning with those power imbalances and reckoning the change the way that we work. The vast majority of our staff, almost 90%, is from the communities that we serve. And our goal and what we've worked towards is that communities really designing their own solutions to the problems they face. We've seen that giving is up, which underscores that there is still a level of trust in our sector, but the global need is far outpacing giving. I think what we're doing and what we've been committed to is really being transparent about our results, where we are, the types of programming that we're doing, and also talking about some of the benefits of working with an organization that has a track history of doing this work in multiple countries and how we take learnings and data and evidence to kind of keep improving that is important. And actually the feedback both ways from all the transparency has been very good. I'm hopeful the sector as a whole will re-earn the trust that may have been lost.
I love this notion of transparency and trust that you've brought up a couple of times. I think it's very powerful both for your fundraising efforts and for your work with a variety of different stakeholders on the ground. That decreased trust that we've seen across the sector, has it specifically affected your work in any way?
I think we've just had to make the case around all the things that people get from organizations like ours that may have stronger policies around making sure that people are safe and understanding like rules and risk and things like that. But ultimately people make their choices and those are respected. We also work in deep partnership with a lot of organizations in Ukraine. Almost all of our work is being done through local partners. So talking about that in the communities that we serve and doing the work, I think we have been very fortunate that we've been in a lot of our communities for a long time. So people know our staff, they trust our staff, that hasn't eroded. We're very transparent about who our funding is. And we also work really hard to be in constant partnership with local organizations. And right now we really think about partnership beyond just the sharing of money. It really is about an equal distribution of power and decision about where those resources are allocated.
To our listeners, we're excited to bring you season 3 starting in early November. And as always, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers.